Thank you. Boy, what 4 days off will do. My mom and
mom box. So nice.
So, Mr. Campidi, how are you?
Fine this morning. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Ready? This case, I'm Vincent M. Campidi. I represent the appellant, Kathy Horvath. Her house burned down back in 2009. She subsequently made a claim to her insurance company. The claim was denied. We filed suit. It was a $1.6 million claim. The court, as part of the pretrial motions, we filed a motion in limine to disallow any evidence of a prior conviction. Ms. Horvath, when she was approximately 19 or 20, it's in the record, I can't remember, she worked for a bank.
No, you know, we've got it all.
All right.
But the fact of the matter is, she's the plaintiff. She was a key witness, if not the key witness. One theory was that she was trying to defraud West Bend. Mm-hmm. And she has a prior conviction for somewhat similar crimes of dishonesty. So why wouldn't the prior conviction be a relevant data point in evaluating her credibility?
Well, I think the reason is because, number one, utilizing the factors that this court uses, Seventh Circuit, and that is those listed under Mahomes, if you take a look at the cases themselves, I'm sorry, this case in particular, the defense argues for one thing that these cases are so similar that the two situations are so similar that should be a reason as to why it should weigh in favor of entering them. However, if you take a look at actual the reasoning behind the rule, and specifically it came in a case that was cited in the Mahone case, and the point is that if you have two cases so similar situations, that's where the danger comes in, especially in a criminal context. Obviously, if you have a bank robbery conviction and then the person is on trial for bank robbery, the idea is that you do not allow the prior conviction in that old, because the jury at that time may simply believe and have a propensity to believe that she's guilty this time.
Well, let me be very honest with you. It seems that apart from the 1992 conviction, Ms. Horvath has engaged in a pattern of sketchy, if not outright fraudulent behavior. I think it's virtually impossible for you to make the case that the 1992 conviction represents an isolated or uncharacteristic incident in her light. I must tell you.
I understand. And I would respectfully disagree. And the reason is because if you look at the court's analysis, the district court, Judge Nectarline, his analysis and the reason he weighed in favor of allowing it in is based upon two things, and that is the supposed subsequent history of conduct. And the only two things he focused on was, number one, a default judgment. I have the judgment here. It is clearly a default judgment. It was the case Burton v. Kathy Horvath, where the court entered on a form submitted by the defendant or by the plaintiff, findings of fact and conclusions of law, and summary judgment for the plaintiff. The defendant, in the first paragraph, the defendant did not appear and was defaulted. The court looked at that. She provided no defense to the action. The court, for that reason, I think utilized a default judgment to suggest and rely on or to use to support the proposition that was one instance of subsequent conduct that supposedly allows a 20-year-old conviction to come in. If you take a look at the findings of fact in that case, they specifically do say that she misrepresented this or that to the buyers of a particular property. However, as I say, that is a default judgment.
So how do you get around the Indiana appellate court's decision, that case involving the paternity suit where
sure.
She made a string of false accusations?
I understand, and I have that case here. And the problem with that is the court did not quote it accurately. Under that appellate decision, if you read the appellate decision, it's very clear that the appellate court does not know what happened. It's either, number one, the child was lying, the child was making these statements and the mother entertained them, believed her son. You're talking about in the middle of a custody suit. Woman is in the process of having her child ripped away. She believes that the parent, the other parent, is doing dastardly things to her son. She believes him. And she moves it forward and she makes and states the accusations. Or the second proposition was that the mother made him up and told the child to do it. There never was a finding. In the original underlying case by Judge Nemeth, it's clear. He says either or. Either number one, child lying, mom entertained, or number two, mother is lying and forcing the kid to do it. The appellate court states the same thing. The only thing that was clear is that the accusations, whether made by the child and entertained by mother or the other, or mother lied, were at least not supported by the evidence. So again, to rely on appellate court decision, which only assert and not reading the underlying record, that is the actual case and decision by Judge Nemeth, simply reading a appellate decision, that was the second basis that the court decided that Ms. Horvath had a subsequent history. And again, if you read, and it's quoted on page of the defense brief, they quote the court, and the court says, the Court of Appeals felt that the probate court of St. Joseph County was well within their grounds for finding that Horvath was engaged in a string of false accusations. And that's not true. It's not what the appellate court found. Not at all. The appellate court in the decision specifically found that either N.S., the child, is telling lies about father and mother is encouraging and entertaining the lies, or mother is coercing N.S. to make the allegations. Two very, very, very different things. And that was the evidence of the underlying case. I don't believe that is sufficient enough. And the whole point here is that based upon the time reference, all these other allegations about lies, et cetera, by Ms. Horvath that the defense brief goes ad nauseum on and on about have explanations. The bankruptcy petition, for example, at trial, the evidence was my attorney advised me to do that. The evidence was it was filed. The evidence also was
she claims a $5,400 Gucci watch, and then in front of the jury admits, oh, well, no, it wasn't that after all. It was only a $300 or $400 watch. And so on. She admits lies in the presence of the jury.
Well, that's the problem, Judge, Your Honor, and the problem is that they aren't lies. The problem is that she relied upon...
So it was a $5,400 watch?
The point is, Judge, there were approximately 20,000 items with almost 300 pages of items prepared by a public adjuster in a list. This information went from Ms. Horvath to a public adjuster to another third party that put the list together. Ms. Horvath completely said, I didn't read everyone. 20,000 pages, I didn't read them. Yeah, you can pick out 5 out of 20,000 and attack her in federal court and make her look like a liar. And how does that have so much importance? And why didn't the other side believe that, yeah, maybe I didn't really read it? Because of the fact that she had been the prior conviction 20 years before. And that's the whole point. It tainted it so bad that the jury, had absolutely zero opportunity to enter into any kind of fact-finding analysis. They completely, I think, disregarded anything Ms. Horvath had to say. So where she had an explanation for each and every situation, because of the taint of that conviction, the whole process was destroyed. And anything she said, she's probably not telling the truth. You're not even going to think about the fact that, yeah, if I listen to the public adjuster testimony, if I listen to the fact that there's 20,000 items, could anybody really read this tiny print on these documents? Should she have? Sure, maybe. There's a big difference between saying you should have read it and you signed it and you agreed to it and saying you lied and you meant to defraud. You're talking about a $600,000 claim in personal property. My point is that, and what I'm trying to say here, and our brief kind of goes through it, if you look at the factors, the first three factors, I believe, clearly disfavor entering this as evidence. Where the final two, I don't think are probably not an argument. I did reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, so.
I know, but you used it. But I will give you some time.
Okay, yeah. I apologize.
Right, right.
All right.
Don't worry.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. Mr. McGrath? Oh, no, no. What am I doing? Do you see what a day off does? Mr. Finn.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Thomas Finn on behalf of the defendant, or Appley West Bend Mutual Insurance Company. Your Honor, we respectfully submit that the appellant has failed to meet her substantial burden to establish that the district court abused its discretion. She's failed to establish that the court's decision was based upon an erroneous conclusion of law, which is part of the standard. There's been no argument to that effect. She's failed to show that the record contains no evidence on which the court rationally based its decision. She makes no argument to that effect. She has failed to show that the facts supposed are clearly erroneous. Again, she has made no argument as such. That is the burden of proof that she must show to establish that this trial court abused its discretion. She has to show that no reasonable men could not differ that the trial court's ruling was improper. There's a couple of double negatives in there, but there's been no such argument.
Or reasonable people, I suppose.
Reasonable people.
Just limited to men.
Maybe I'm looking at an old case.
We know there's no such thing as a reasonable man.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Just talk to my wife. It seems that the appellant's sole argument is the court failed to give proper weight to her prior 20-year-old conviction, and that therefore that was an abuse of discretion. Yet the record is clear that the court gave a thorough and thoughtful analysis of this specific factor. Additionally, the appellant must show that without the admission of this conviction, there would have been a substantial likelihood that the jury's verdict would have been different. That's her burden of proof. That's her burden to establish in this appellate court. There's been no such showing. In fact, there is no such argument made by the appellant in this case. The appellant concedes that the five factors, which are just a guide, in essence, that the trial court must use to weigh the probative value, two of those five factors clearly favor admission of the conviction. The first factor, which they really don't contest, is the impeachment value. If you read the court's analysis, he thoroughly analyzed that factor. Similarly, the third factor, the similarity between the past crime and the issues before the jury, the court certainly went through that and favored that admission. The real factor then that they take issue with is the point in time of the conviction and the witness's subsequent history. And I think the court recognizes that there is a subsequent history between the original conviction and this woman's subsequent history. The court talked about and analyzed the fact that not just the two court cases, but that she perjured herself in the bankruptcy court when she filed that bankruptcy petition in August 2007. The court noted that the St. Joseph Circuit Court found specific findings of fact in July of 2008 that she had been misrepresenting facts and had been involved in a cover-up of some water damage. And the court also looked at the appellate court's decision in the paternity case and found that the appellate court specifically found factors similar wrongdoings. And I'll direct the court, I think counsel misquoted what the appellate court ruled. The appellate court, in its ruling, and I think it's at 908 Northeast 2nd, 1276, specifically said that, quote, the evidence is clear that mother had launched a string of accusations against father from sexual abuse to physical abuse to imprisoning NS in a crawl space. The evidence is equally clear that none of the allegations have been substantiated despite extensive investigation by DCS and the police department. The court went on to hold, therefore, the evidence supports the trial court's findings. So when this trial court made its analysis, it looked at all of these factors. It thoroughly analyzed the facts, and it verified the probative proof value. And so if you look at U.S. versus Reddick, that's what the court did. It went through it. It articulated how it was going to rule, and it ruled that the probative value of the conviction outweighed its potential prejudicial effect. And I think most importantly, there was, well, there's another issue that there was the court in its final instructions, I believe it was final instruction 16, gave a limiting instruction which specifically told the jurors that you are to consider this criminal conviction only for the purposes of weighing the witness's credibility and assessing her credibility. So we have a limiting instruction, which the courts have acknowledged that, you know, when you have such a limited instruction, that also shows that there has been no abuse of discretion. I also note that the appellant herself brought out the conviction in her direct testimony, which arguably under Claret versus Roberts, where this court has held that she has even waived that argument here on appeal. She made a tactical decision to take the sting out of that potential conviction, and she made an issue of addressing it in her direct examination. And if you look at the Claret versus Roberts court, they specifically said, when you make that tactical decision, you waive your right to argue this. There has been no evidence or argument that the jury's verdict would have been different had this conviction not gone in. As the court notes, there was overwhelming evidence of prior inconsistent statements. She was impeached repeatedly. I think the most damning impeachment was she had to acknowledge that she lied in open court before the jury and before the judge. She got up and she told the jury and she told the judge that she had never, ever signed one single document in the bankruptcy court. And she came up with this fictitious that my attorney made me do that. And I never signed one document. There were seven separate signed documents which she was shown, and she had to admit to both the court and the jury that, folks, I just lied to you yesterday. I lied through my teeth. The evidence was overwhelming. This woman could not be believed. She was impeached by her own testimony. I submit to the court that the criminal conviction, if it had not gone in, they haven't established that the jury verdict would have been different. The court thoroughly analyzed the factors that it was called to do. Its ruling was proper, and we submit that the appellant has failed to meet her very strenuous burden to show that there has been an abuse of discretion. And we respectfully request that this court affirm the trial court's ruling.
Thank you very much. Give you another 2 minutes.
Once again, I mean, our point simply is that there's no way to prove to you, sure, that the result would have been the same. Looking at the totality of the evidence, I think every piece of every single attack made by counsel at the trial, Ms. Horvath had a reasonable explanation for. The problem is that once you target somebody and paint somebody with a crime of dishonesty 20 years before when she was 19, a totally different and completely different person at that time, you are tainting her character and besmirching it for the jury so that they cannot reasonably listen to anything she says.
Well, let me just ask you about her lying in front of the jury and admitting she's lying. So where do we put that evidence? That seems
it's an entire misstatement of the record. I do not believe she admitted that she was lying. I believe she admitted that she was wrong. I don't believe she said that she lied. I don't believe that's in the record at all. I believe that what she said was she was on direct examination. She was asked these questions by me on cross-examination or whatever. I believe she was confronted with the bankruptcy petitions that she did sign many years before and then told her attorney to withdraw the bankruptcy. I don't want to go forward, and it was dismissed. She never appeared in the bankruptcy court. She was in an attorney's office. Her testimony was, I did sign the documents. They were not filled out. I forgot. So big difference between, and that's a total, that's his characterization, that she lied through her teeth. She did not get up there and admit, yes, I lied, to you. That did not happen. And that's my whole point here. That's his, and that's in the court, in the case that I found is Gordon versus U.S., 383 F. 2nd, 936. It was quoted in a Seventh Circuit case, 537 F. 2nd, 922. And the whole point is that convictions which are for the same crime should be admitted sparingly because the pressure on the jurors to conclude it happened before it can happen now. And that is exactly what has happened here. These jurors threw everything out the window and believed everything they said. Once they had that conviction in, very easy from there. Everything you paint is a lie. Let's paint this as a lie. A lie, a lie, a lie. And these people believe it. And any reasonable person might. But I think that is where we're at. I'd ask that the court affirm, reverse the ruling and send it back to the trial court for a new trial without allowing the evidence to come in. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both parties, and the case will be taken under advisement.